To get in touch with the civilizations that came before us for thousands of years, there's no better place than to be along Turkey's Aegean coast.
It's like the layers of a baklava, one historical level on top of historical level.
Coming up, expert guides recommend city and backroad adventures designed to stoke your spirit. In Italy, try a walk around Florence after dark.
Because if you want to do a night walk of Florence when most of the crowds are gone, that's, in my opinion, the best time of the day.
It's a living museum.
And in Denmark, there are plenty of day trips and small town options beyond Copenhagen. Places to help you relax and enjoy the moment, Danish style.
These are small harbor towns where you can buy fresh fish, sit on a bench, grab a picnic lunch. That's a very Danish thing to do.
Stick around for the hour ahead as we chill out in Western Turkey, Tuscany, and Denmark. It's Travel with Rick Steves. It's been ranked as the second happiest country in the world since 2019 by the World Happiness Index. In just a bit, guides from Denmark recommend how you can get a taste of the modest good life the Danes enjoy in the cozy coastal towns and countryside beyond the capital city of Copenhagen. And guides from Italy offer their advice for savoring the idyllic landscapes of Tuscany, both in historic Florence and in their favorite medieval hilltop towns. Let's open today's Travel with Rick Steves along the western coast of Turkey. Turkey's Aegean coast is a favorite destination among Turks for its quaint B&Bs, chances to dine on local cheeses, and stumble upon historic ruins. With its temperate weather, charming villages, olive farms, and wineries, you'll discover why the locals choose vacationing here time and time again. Our guide to this often overlooked region is Lolly Sermon. Lolly, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting, and merhaba.
Merhaba. We've talked about so many things over the years, but what I really like right now is we're going to talk about a region of Turkey that Americans don't really give much thought to, but it's very popular with Turkish people looking for a coastal vacation area.
That is our choice to vacation.
So this is the entertaining coastline for the locals, and it is the Aegean. Now, there's a Black Sea coast, there's a Bosporus, there's a Mediterranean coast. My image on the Mediterranean is there's just lots of mass tourism resorts and so on.
Exactly.
And I wouldn't, for me, that's just not my cup of tea, even
it's
Turkish
okay.
tea.
Maybe it's not yours, but it's some other people's.
Yeah.
It's not ours, but they're okay.
Sure.
We don't go there.
If you're a Russian looking for a cheap place to hang out on Turkey's south coast, you'd probably go to the Mediterranean coast.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, but let's say you're somebody who has a family in Istanbul and you have a car and you want to drive 4 hours away and get to a whole different world and have some coastal fun, this would be it, wouldn't it?
Definitely. Transportation is so easy. You can drive, you can fly. There are freeways and toll roads, bridges, that's making all very easy.
It's remarkable to me because I haven't driven in Turkey for a long time. But if you pull out a map and you show me how far it is from Istanbul to Izmir, for example, on the center of the Aegean coast, it's remarkable that that now is connected by super freeways.
Yes.
Tollways, and just nonstop, you go just like you're in
4 hours.
Just like Germany, 4 hours.
Yes.
So this is quite adventurous, I'm thinking, for a lot of Americans dreaming about Turkey, to actually rent a car and head out into the countryside. But are there any, let's say we're accustomed to driving in France or in Italy, is there anything different about driving in Turkey from a car rental point of view?
Not
from a license, international license,
not
filling up the tank? That's great.
It's, if you can drive in south of France, southern Italy, you'll be as good in Turkey.
Let's talk about that coast, the Aegean coast. What would characterize it? What is it like?
First of all, speaking historically, that is where the Greek and Roman cultures are consolidated. That's where intensely they are. Yes, they are.
That's right. The Ionia.
Ionia, yes.
Ionia was a Greek colony in present-day Turkey.
Yes. So that is where you get to see most of the Greek and Roman history, and that is where the most delicious fruits and vegetables of our country also come from.
So the ancients were not stupid to live there.
No.
It was a nice place to live.
They knew what they were doing.
Nice fruits
lots
and vegetables.
Lots of rivers running to the Aegean, lots of valleys, lots of mountains. That is why the coastline is very intricate, but not a flat line.
And you know,
it is very twisty.
Speaking of twisty and rivers, I learned from you there's a river in Turkey called
Meander.
Meander.
It meanders.
It meanders, and we get that word from that.
Yes.
What a delight. Okay, so you have this higgly-piggly coastal area. What about the infrastructure for travelers? Where would you sleep?
Nowadays, it is excellent. And with the ease of transportation, of course, investments increased naturally. But the good thing is that they are not giant resorts, because giant hotels.
When I think of investment in tourism in Turkey, to be honest, I think of overbuilt high-rise hotels.
No.
This is different.
No, it is mom-and-pop restaurants,
nice, small
boutique hotels converted from historic homes at times, sometimes new homes, but they're small. Nothing giant.
Ah, and everything is accessible because you have good roads.
Yes.
And you have all of this produce. There are different areas. I understand there's one region that is famous for cheese, and another
yes, that's
famous for olives.
Yes.
And another that's famous for wine.
And their food is very delicious too, usually natural produce. They're very proud that their vegetables and fruits are cooked under the sun, not picked before they're ripe.
Cooked under the sun.
Cooked under the sun. That's what they say. They don't cook it physically, but
no,
they keep the produce on the branches till it's ripe. For Americans and for the rest of the world, I know that the among the finest is what you would call the Mediterranean cuisine. For us, it's the Aegean cuisine.
And that is based on olive oil?
Olive oil, the grazing land on this area,
mm-hmm, which
gives the milk and the cheese and the yogurt a special taste. And the herbs that grow wild in the mountains.
So, okay, so you've got this wonderful opportunity to enjoy great infrastructure, boutique hotels, local cheese.
And you know what? Vendors will be welcoming Americans, not used to seeing many Americans.
Is there a language barrier?
I wouldn't say it's a barrier. You
no,
can still get along.
It's
but
a hurdle,
not,
yeah.
Yes, it's not like those in the Grand Bazaar.
But what I like to do is find a town where there's commerce, and the commerce is designed for the local people, not the tourists.
Yes, and there are beautiful produce markets, and there's a produce market in every village once every week.
Oh, that's great. Lali Sermon Aran is our guide to the west coast of Turkey right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Lali and her husband, Tan, co-authored the Rick Steves Istanbul Guidebook, and they operate SRM Travel from their home base in Istanbul. They also run a boutique hotel in Cappadocia in the center of Turkey. Her website is laliaran.com, spelled L-A-L-E-A-R-A-N. So, Lali, we've talked about all the edible fun. There's a lot of history along here. What would be some of the must-see historical sites on this Aegean coastline?
Oh, the first place I'd recommend you see is ancient Troy.
Troy?
Yes, Troy from Homer's Iliad.
Yeah.
Visualize the Trojan battle there. The site is very well organized. It's like the layers of a baklava, one historical level on top of the other historical level, starting from the earliest to the very top, to the Roman period. And they built a top-notch Troy Museum very recently, and it's getting into the UNESCO Heritage List.
You know, that is one thing that I think we should remind people is when there's a very important site of antiquity, generally in the last generation, they've built a wonderful museum driven in part by the need to take the art treasures out of the elements and protect them, but also present it better. So don't go to an ancient site without being sure to check out the little museum
exactly,
that's right there.
I agree. But you wouldn't call the Troy Museum a little one anymore.
Okay, that's good. Because I remember the one at Aphrodisias, which is an amazing museum.
And it's not little anymore.
It's not. So this
no,
is, okay, so there's
they're
lots
expanded,
of treasures.
Upgraded, yes.
Okay, so we have Troy. Talk about another ancient Greek or Roman site we'd want to check out.
Continuing southwards from Troy, driving around, you will see lots of brown road signs. If it is brown, it indicates an ancient city. And there is another in every few miles.
Yeah.
So you cannot get away from that. But the outstanding ones would be Troy. Then comes Pergamon, ancient city, which was the leading city of the Hellenistic period, predating the Roman period.
And we know about that because of the Pergamum Museum in Berlin.
Yes.
And the German archaeologist apparently got to take home some of their favorite
finds. The altar
finds.
Of Zeus.
But they left things there, and there's still lots to see at Pergamum.
They've left the city.
Oh, well, that was nice of them.
Yes. They took the altar, but the city is still there. And it's a beautiful example of a historical acropolis perched very high on a mountain top with a view of the valley from every side of it.
Wow. You know, one of my, I like to say, arguably my favorite ancient site is Ephesus. And that's right by Kusadashi.
Yes.
It's very near.
Yes.
How does that stack up?
It is the most extensively excavated Roman ancient city anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Once upon a time, the population of Ephesus was about 250,000 people. It was a bustling port, a busy port. So that was the springboard of business was Ephesus.
Now today, it's a cruise port, Kusadashi, and cruisers want to go to Ephesus, understandably so. But I would think most of the Aegean is not plagued by cruise crowds.
No, not at all. It's only Ephesus, near Ephesus, they stop in Kusadasi. Uh-huh. Very few stops nearby Troy, and lesser stop by Bodrum. Bodrum,
Bodrum. Lolly, there are a lot of biblical sites along the Aegean coast.
Yes.
What would we be looking for if we're looking to walk in the footsteps of Paul or something like that?
Ephesus is a must for that in that respect, because that's where he lived for a while and wrote letters to the Ephesians also afterwards. But also there are the seven churches of Revelation.
Huh, tell us about that.
These are very close to the coastline. When talking about the seven churches of Revelation, we're not actually talking about physical church buildings, but congregations.
Okay. There ancient are ancient communities.
Yes, communities. And in a road trip of the Aegean coastline, these are very easily accessible from the big sites, and they are clustered very close by to one another. All of them, you can do it in 2 days.
Well, what is one that you would think is a highlight of those seven?
Well, Laodicea, I can list one.
Uh-huh.
It is recently extensively excavated as glamorous as Ephesus, the monuments there. It was a very rich merchant city once upon a time. And the monuments reflect it, and it was one of the seven churches of the Revelation.
You know, when we think about the Aegean coast, some people might think that's a long way away, but if you are going to the Greek islands and you go to Samos or if you go to Rhodos, you can cross right over to the Turkish mainland, and then you could pick up a car and do this adventure we're talking about. One of those ports would be Bodrum and Marmaris down by Rhodes.
Yes.
What would we find in that part of the south end of the Aegean coast?
Bodrum is the peak destination for Turkish vacationers.
Bodrum.
It is very popular among the Turks. There's a town called Bodrum, but the greater Bodrum is the peninsula that extends from the town of Bodrum.
Uh-huh.
It is full of little villages. Bodrum is a small beach city, but with a lot of facilities.
Uh-huh.
Restaurants, hotels, art community.
And from around there, you could catch the boat to Rhodes.
And to Simi.
And to Simi. These would be Greek islands.
Yes.
Where from there, you can catch a boat right over to Athens.
Or a flight.
Or a flight.
The distance is longer. These islands are closer to Turkey than they are to Greece.
It is interesting how many Greek islands rub right up against the Turkish coast. Lolly Sermon-Aran, thank you so much for shining a light on a part of Turkey that a lot of us don't even seriously consider. But this makes me think of actually having the Aegean coast to be a destination of its own.
Definitely, yes.
Teşekkür.
Rica ederim. Thank you for inviting.
Lolly recommends the wine country northwest of Istanbul and a famous mosque near the Bulgarian border. It's in an extra to today's interview at ricksteves.com/radio. Up next, Lace Up, as we walk in the footsteps of Michelangelo, Leonardo, and Botticelli on the streets of Florence and wander the countryside of Tuscany and Denmark on Travel with Rick Steves. We're at 877-333-RICK. Small but mighty, Florence, Italy is the home of some of the greatest art and architecture in the world. In a single Florentine day, you can look Michelangelo's David in the eyes, you can fall under the seductive sway of Botticelli's Birth of Venus, and climb the dome that kicked off the architectural Renaissance. But you definitely won't be the only one there, and you'll likely soon need a break from the crowds. Thankfully, Tuscany awaits just beyond the city limits, where you can venture out into the surrounding cypress-dotted hills and get lost in the thyme and wine-soaked villages of the romantic heart of Italy. I'm joined today by two guides from Italy to recommend ways to manage the crowds in bustling, art-packed Florence and to share some tips about slowing down in Tuscany. David Torti is an Italian who's been guiding since 2005, and Lisa Anderson is an American who married an Italian and has been guiding in Italy now for about 25 years. Lisa and David, thanks so much for joining us.
Grazie.
Grazie, thank you.
Wow, there's so much to talk about with Florence and then the countryside.
There is a whole lot of fun packed into Tuscany.
And you guys earn your living helping Americans sort this out. First of all, let's just think about Florence quickly, and then we'll get into the countryside. Top sites and how to manage the crowds. When you're thinking about Florence, if you got a couple of days in Florence, Lisa, what would the structure of a visit generally be?
Well, just walking outside and seeing all of the magnificent buildings, the Duomo, the Baptistry, the Bargello, the City Hall from the outside, Ponte Vecchio. We can't forget Ponte Vecchio. Is amazing. It's a living museum. I mean, and it really is truly lived in, not just by tourists. And then, of course, you have to go to the Uffizi, the Accademia. Those are the top. Pick at least one church, Santa Croce, Santa Maria Novella.
And the points that you mentioned in the beginning is what I call the Renaissance Walk.
Exactly.
It's right there. If you look at the circular road that comes up from the Arno River, that would be the medieval walls of the town. And almost everything of importance is within that echo of the old walls. David, how would you augment what Lisa just said for Florence?
Well, all the highlights that she mentioned can be seen at different times of the day and at night. Because if you want to do a night walk of Florence when most of the crowds are gone, that's, in my opinion, the best time of the day. And
important with all the crowds and the heat, because Florence is really hot and really crowded. And a lot of people are wasting magic hours of the evening sitting in their hotel room. When you could take a siesta and then you could get out there and enjoy the Renaissance walk in a floodlit city without the crowds.
Absolutamente.
In the morning as well. Early in the morning is amazing too, yeah.
Very important.
Yeah. I do it all the time.
You know, the Uffizi Gallery is a U-shaped building. Uffizi means offices, right? Mm-hmm. So that was the office building of the big palace. And that U-shaped courtyard that tourists love, I love it, is literally a human traffic jam in the middle of the day. It is absolutely packed with humanity. And at night, you go by and it's like, have I already been here? I don't remember this. It was totally different. It's just
unrecognizable. It's you and a few.
It's what it is. It's architectural lines. You see the beautiful mathematics of the architecture all around you. And in each niche is one of the superheroes of the Renaissance, the statue.
Absolutely.
I love it.
Great artists and writers.
So now, David, Lisa talked about the core of Florence. But you got to cross the river, don't you?
Oh, yeah. You got to go to the Oltrarno, over the Arno.
Oltrarno.
Oltrarno is the district over the Arno River. Arno is the river that splits Florence into two, any other Roman
city. Well, like in Rome, you've got Trastevere.
Trastevere, over the Tiber.
Yeah. Okay.
Oltrarno. And
so why would you venture over the altar on the other side?
Well, for one, first thing, I mean, the Oltrarno has probably 10% of the crowds. Yeah. 90% are on the famous side.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that it's less beautiful. The Oltrarno is amazing, in my opinion.
You know, when you said that, there is an elevated passageway, if you happen to be a Medici, that you can go from the intensity of Florence above the crowds, over the river, and all the way to a big palace.
Yeah. The Vasari Corridor.
The Vasari Corridor and the Boboli Palace. And I was thinking about crowds because I'm fascinated by how Americans put themselves in the most crowded place in the most crowded time, and they sit there waiting through all of these miserable lines when you could compromise just a little bit on the site you're going to see and have no crowds. In Florence, a classic example is the Uffizi is on everybody's list. The Museo del Duomo, the Museum of the Cathedral, it's got just as many textbook pieces of Florentine art masterpieces.
And it's absolutely. I mean, the composition of the museum, the way it's been laid out since it was renovated is absolutely incredible.
And I've never seen it crowded.
No, crowded.
It's never crowded.
Same for the Bargello Museum, the National Sculpture Gallery of Florence. I mean, it's one of the masterpieces in Europe.
It is to statues what the Uffizi is to paintings.
Correct.
I love
it. Bargello and San Marco, also the Museum of San Marco.
Oh, you're getting me all excited.
There's two people a day, and if you go there, you have the same quality of the Uffizi.
I want to stand up and just scream sometimes because everybody is mobbed at the Uffizi, hot, sweaty, wasting time and in a bad mood. And I'm telling them, it's a 10-minute walk to the Bargello. You got Donatello, you got Ghiberti, you got Michelangelo. It's a 10-minute walk to the Museum of the Cathedral. And you've got Michelangelo's great Pietà. You've got Donatello. You've got all the great art of that church. And then it's another 10-minute walk to San Marco. And if you don't know Fra Angelico, you don't know what you're missing. Fra Angelico, he's the most sumptuous painter of the Middle Ages.
Absolutely.
The High Middle Ages.
And the library there that Michelozzi created. Michelozzi was one of, I think it was Cosimo de' Medici's favorite architects. Am I remembering correctly?
I think so, yeah.
And then what I was thinking about, we're talking about Alto Arno, the other side of the river, the Boboli Garden, the Boboli Palace. Amazing collection of paintings there in a massive palace and no crowds.
Yeah, Pitti Palace, Boboli Garden, also the Bardini Gardens. The gardens up the hill, there are free entrance. Beautiful view. The best view of Florence from the Oltrarno is from the Bardini Gardens.
We're getting you ready for a magnificent trip to Florence and the surrounding countryside of Tuscany right now on Travel with Rick Steves. David Tordi is a tour guide who specializes in central Italy and is based in Orvieto, a short drive south of Tuscany. He also fronts for his band called Bartender. And American-born Lisa Anderson also guides visitors around Italy and is raising her Italo-Americano family in the Piedmont region of Italy, just a bit north of Tuscany. You'll find links to our guests with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Let's head out now for a day trip into the Tuscan countryside. So, Lisa, where would you recommend we start?
Lovely Fiesole.
Fiesole.
Fiesole. Take the bus from the center of Florence and get into this wonderful town that was built by the Etruscans.
Yeah, it's a hill town right
Outside
of Florence.
Yeah, and Fiesole. It's got some wonderful sites, not just restaurants, an old arena, and a beautiful view.
And an easy bus connection from downtown Florence.
Exactly. Public buses, it's inexpensive.
David, another side trip from Florence?
Any bus into the Chianti region, south of Florence, you would love exploring a couple of the towns of Chianti, Greve in Chianti, Castellina in Chianti.
So all of these classic, you're in the Tuscan sun kind of escapes.
Wonderful destinations. Also, other towns that you can visit very close are, in my opinion, Pistoia.
Pistoia
is a breeze from Florence, and it's one of the most underrated Tuscan towns.
I've never been there.
Oh,
Pistoia.
My gosh.
How long does it take to go there?
Oh, half an hour.
Half an hour.
From Florence. It's incredible.
Pistoia. How do you spell that?
P-I-S-T-O-I-A.
I'll let Lisa spell it because she's an American. How do you spell it?
P-I-S-T-O-I-A, Pistoia.
I was right.
I-N-E, I-N-E is, I get so confused, the European pronunciation of
also
I-N-E.
Also Lucca in Siena.
Luca. So like about an hour away, you can see Pisa, Lucca, Siena. There's so much to see so close. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Lisa Anderson and David Tordi. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. You can email us at radio@ricksteves.com. And let's see, Zach is on the line from Boston. Hey, Zach.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Thanks for your call. Have you been to Florence lately?
Not lately, but I've been there twice.
Uh-huh. Do you have a question or a comment for our guests?
Well, my question was going to be what exciting side trips should we take besides Pisa or Siena or Lucca, but I just heard you guys talk about two great little towns that I think I'm going to check out. One of them was Pistoia?
Pistoia.
Okay. Pistoia.
Pistoia. Okay.
There you go.
I would say also Arezzo.
And what was the other one you mentioned?
Well, Lisa just brought up another one, which sounds great. Arezzo.
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 Which is where, if I'm not mistaken, Vasari.
Yes.
Came from Giorgio Vasari, who wrote all about the lives of the famous artists and architects in the Renaissance. And
it's less than an hour train ride south of Florence. Beautiful, beautiful town.
Fantastic.
Yeah, okay. So, Zach, you're like a lot of Americans. You've been to Florence twice, and you're ready to go back, but you want to augment the experience by getting out into the countryside. And I would remind you, don't worry too much about renting a car if you'd rather just take public transit, because you can get around with public transit surprisingly well in Italy. But the point is, Lotz is nearby Florence. And you can do it as day trips or you can do it as overnights. Zach, thanks for your call.
Thank you, Rick.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. I'm talking with Lisa Anderson and David Tordi. We're talking about Florence and side trips. Let's think about doing something in Florence that might be a little bit under the radar, something that's an experience. Do you got any ideas on how we can distinguish our visit to Florence with some special activity?
Cooking classes, there are cooking classes all over. Some are at the Mercato Centrale. You can look on their website. Yeah. Some are through private citizens that just invite people into their homes, I think, you know, guided by kind
That's
of things.
Great. Yeah.
There are so many good things. In Tavola is a great cooking school.
In Tavola.
In Tavola.
All right. David, any ideas about some activity or some offbeat site while you're in Florence?
Definitely. Florence is famous also for its beautiful food markets. The Mercato Centrale is the main, the central market.
Yeah.
But then each district has their own temporary or permanent markets. For example, the Mercato of Sant'Ambrogio, the Sant'Ambrogio Market. And that's an incredible place because it basically serves only the locals.
Yeah.
And it's a market dedicated to the locals and not to the tourists.
Yeah,
and yet,
I got to say, the Mercato Centrale is great physically, and it was great, but it's quite touristy now. It's still fun.
Oh, yeah.
And you got the ground floor has got this food fight of beautiful market stalls and everything. And upstairs, you've got all of these little one-off branches of existing restaurants that are right there.
And you've got communal tables, so you just roam around with your friends and you meet at the table and you buy whatever you want. And it's reasonable. It's not cheap, but it's reasonable. And it's fun.
It's an Italian food court.
Yeah, that's what
upstairs.
It is.
The upstairs. It's there an Italian
go.
Food court.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think what I would like to do is find the more local style alternative to the market, the central
Sant'Ambrogio
market.
Sant'Ambrogio,
which is not far from the Church of Santa Croce.
Yeah.
But also the district markets in the Old Trarno, again, over the Arno River,
right.
Depending where, not far from Santo Spirito Church, for example, there's always beautiful fruit and vegetables and cheese and deli shops. And they're all locals. And the customers are only the locals.
You know, you just mentioned the church.
Santo Spirito.
Santo Spirito, yes.
And it reminds me, when you get a little bit away from the center and you step into a few particular churches, you'll find no crowds and you'll be all alone with one of the most magnificent pieces of art that art historians have drooled over for 500 years. I mean, frescoes by Masaccio, statues by Michelangelo, Donatello, great paintings. Think of a couple of those in Florence. You can see the Masaccio.
Santo Spirito for one of the most incredible wooden crucifixes in the world by Michelangelo.
Yes.
That's mind-blowing.
And architecture by Brunelleschi.
And the Trinity by Masaccio.
Yeah, the Trinity by Masaccio, the paintings by Masaccio in the Trinità. And also back on the other side of Florence, one thing that many people don't go to is the Hospital of the Innocents. The Hospital of the Innocents, designed by Brunelleschi.
Oh, that's an
the
amazing
The architecture
places.
Of it is amazing. And on top, there's a rooftop bar.
Yeah.
Right?
With a great view of the cupola by Brunelleschi's cupola.
So you've seen all your Brunelleschis and your Donatellos, and you're ready for a nice cup of coffee.
Or a spritz.
With a great view.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. I'm talking with Lisa Anderson and David Torti. We're talking about Florence and Tuscany. Our phone number is 877-333-7425, and Julie is calling in from Northampton, Massachusetts. Hey, Julie.
Hi there.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking the call. My question is about the effect of the Catholic Jubilee year on tourism numbers. I've read that 35 million pilgrims are expected in Rome because of the Jubilee, but I've seen conflicting opinions about how much increase in tourism other areas of Italy will see. And I'm planning to go back to Florence in November, but I hate crowds.
Yeah.
So am I better off waiting, say, until March 2026?
Well, when you ask a question about a Jubilee year, you're kind of asking somebody like about Halley's Comet or something like that, because it only comes around once in every long while. That's every 25 years.
Once every 25 years.
There's a Jubilee year. And the Pope decided to call this one for 2025. I guess that's on time. And true, lots of people will go to Rome for this, and it's most of the year, and it will cause a lot of congestion in Rome. Historically, a lot of these kind of events, they create a great stir, and a lot of journalists love to make it exciting and scary. But we have two guides here that work in Florence, and I'd love to get the question is, how will Jubilee crowds spill beyond Rome? What do you think, David?
I think that Rome is a unique place in the world, for sure. And it's not going to be more crowded than it already is. It's the traveler's approach to travel that has to change and has to update. So if a place is overcrowded during the business hours, again, I invite you, Julie, or anyone else traveling to places like Florence or Rome, be mindful of doing activities early in the morning, maybe do outdoor activities early in the morning or in the evenings at night when the big cruise ships and the big tour groups are gone and you're left not alone, because you're still in Florence and Rome. You'll never be alone, but you will have an incredible experience. And then I suggest you visit off-the-beaten-path sites. And, of course, if you want to do the highlights, I always suggest my friends, when they travel together, create your own bubble around you. Concentrate on the art, on the piece you're looking at. Do not look at the crowds. Just find your own mental space and enjoy it. And that's going to be your crowded moment, of course, because you're in Rome, when you're in Paris or in Florence. But other than that, pace yourself away from the crowds in good hours of the day. And,
thank you. Half the battle is not going where everybody's going at the same time. You can go where everybody's going, but not at the same time. You could go early, right at the crack of dawn when it opens, or you could be there late. I was just at the Vatican Museum, and I was filming in the Pinacoteca, and I had an hour before the place closed.
It
was empty. I walked over to the Sistine Chapel. I have never seen the Sistine Chapel, and this was peak season.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I was there 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening. I had a whole hour. And everybody was back at the hotel comparing war wounds of how crowded it was and how hot it was. It was cool and empty for me because I was using those magic hours by minimizing the crowds.
I would also say it's probable that there's going to be a little overflow from Rome. I would say know yourself and how you like to travel, too. If you're somebody that can fly by the seat of your pants a little bit and don't mind not knowing where you're going to sleep at night, otherwise just be prepared and have an idea. Make your reservations for the really fundamental things.
Yeah.
And again, it is your mindset and how you...
I would say the critical thing, if you're thinking about the Edinburgh Festival or Rome in the Jubilee Year or whatever, when you know there's going to be a crowd, get your hotel figured out. And then if you're going to be a sightseer and you're going to see the famous sights, read your guidebook, find out what you need to book in advance, and
exactly.
Commit yourself. Okay, now you have to go at 10 o'clock because you got a reservation there. But the cool thing about the new post-COVID approach to crowded museums in Europe is during COVID, they learned how to moderate the crowds because they had to. And I think a lot of them like that. So it carries on now, even when it's not necessary from a COVID point of view. But there's no more commotion in Milan at the where you see the Last Supper by Leonardo da Vinci because every 20 minutes, 50 people show up.
Exactly.
Every 20 minutes.
It's absolutely.
It actually feels more comfortable now than a few years ago for some sites because they now moderate the entrances.
The chaos is gone. And you got to moderate that with your own smart planning and compromising your blow as the wind, footloose and fancy freeness a little bit because you're choosing to go to a place that's crowded. Hey, Julie, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Hope you got some good information there. I sure did. I love talking to you guys. This is so much fun sharing our questions and our dreams about traveling in Florence and Tuscany with two great local guides, Lisa Anderson and David Tordi. Mille grazie.
Grazie. Te.
Grazie.
Prego.
Where is life more active and attractive than in Florence?
If you'd rather drive on flat land instead of the winding roads of hilly Tuscany, may we recommend a trip to Denmark? Up next, we'll explore the possibilities just beyond the capital city of Copenhagen. Thanks for coming along. It's Travel with Rick Steves. Many European countries are dominated by their capital city. The Greeks are proud of how you can see nearly half of all the people in their country from the hilltop views on the Acropolis in Athens. Dublin is the cultural and governmental heart of Ireland. Vienna is the same for Austria. Prague, that's the dominant city for the Czechs. And you can't say you've been to Denmark without spending time in its big city, Copenhagen, with its bikeable city center and inviting waterfront promenades. But the islands and peninsula that make up the rest of the country of Denmark have plenty to offer as well. Fairy tale castles, first-rate museums, showing off everything from Viking history to contemporary art. And small farming and fishing towns where you can breathe in that laid-back sense of Danish coziness and the good life are just an easy bus or train ride from the big city. Our guides to Denmark beyond Copenhagen are Camilla Kolding Jorgensen and Anja Kuznar. Camilla and Anja, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So first, I'd love to hear your story because both of you have lived in Denmark and now you're living someplace else and you earn your living guiding people around Europe. Camilla, what's your connection with Denmark?
I was born in Copenhagen, raised in Copenhagen. My mother is Danish. My father came out to Denmark from Turkey. So I'm kind of mixed, but I have been living there all my life until I started to travel a lot.
And now where do you live?
I live in Sicily.
Okay. This is so European, isn't it?
Yeah,
so you've got a Turkish father, a Danish mother.
And I live in Sicily.
Are you still a Danish citizen?
Oh, yeah. Okay. I'm still a Danish citizen.
Very nice.
Yep.
And Anja, what's your story?
So, Rick, I'm coming from Slovenia, which lies on the sunny side of the Alps. But in my past, I traveled abroad and came to Copenhagen, fell in love with a Dane, learned the language, worked there for quite some time. Then I moved back to Slovenia.
You guys live all over the place within Europe. And, you know, you can choose the weather. You can track your loves where you want to live. You can go where your work will be best, or you can choose a society that has designed its the fabric of that society in a way that you like, that fits your style. What I introduced us to was the fact that when we go to Denmark, the typical American traveler just goes to Copenhagen. But the cool thing to remember is Denmark is small, and it's got a great train system, and you can really side trip to most of the country, even in a day. And what I want to talk about right now is some of the great places that you could see outside of Copenhagen. Anja, what would be a side trip you would take if I was visiting Copenhagen and you wanted to get me a good break from capital city.
So Copenhagen lies on an island which is called Sjælland, and it has great train connections, as you mentioned, to the places such as Roskilde. So that will be definitely number one on the list.
Okay, so why is Roskilde number one?
It used to be the seat of a bishop back in the past.
Yeah.
And today you can visit its mighty cathedral, where more than 39 Danish queens and kings are buried in the Roskilde.
I'm a sucker
cathedral.
For these kind of great national cathedrals where you have most of the famous personalities and leaders and kings and queens of a country buried. Everybody loves to go to Westminster Abbey in London, for example. In Krakow, you have Wawel Cathedral, which is amazing. And in Denmark, you would find the royals buried mostly not in Copenhagen, but out in Roskilde. And Roskilde is kind of a twofer, isn't it? Because there's another very important site in Roskilde.
Yeah, you could also dive deeper into Danish past. So you could visit the Viking Ship Museum, and yeah. You would see the larger ships with which the Vikings would cross the oceans. They would sail down the rivers, reach down to the Black Sea, cross the Atlantic
people
Ocean.
People don't realize how wide the Vikings ventured.
Yes, exactly.
Of course, they settled Iceland. Mm-hmm. They settled in Greenland. Mm-hmm. Most people accept that they discovered, quote, America 500 yeah. years before Columbus. Mm-hmm. The word Russia is a Norse word. They went down the rivers into Russia, and the Vikings actually went into the Mediterranean.
Yep.
So the Vikings had, and they had to get there with boats. So I love seeing a Viking ship museum, and Roskilde is great, isn't it?
And you could also see the smaller ships, which were used for hunting whales. And you see nowadays in winter months in Copenhagen, you would still see Danes wearing fur coats made of whale skin.
Skin. Wow. Camila, when you're thinking about Viking ships all over Scandinavia, where's the best place to see Viking ships, would you say?
There are some places up in Oslo, but mm-hmm. I would say Roskilde. I would go there.
It's
definitely.
I was going to ask you because I'm Norwegian heritage
yes,
and you're
I know
Danish.
That.
and there's wonderful Viking ships yeah. at the Viking Ship Museum yeah. in Bygdøy,
yeah.
which I think is closed now because they're doing a big renovation, but yeah. it's going to be great when they open it up. But yeah. the Viking ships in Roskilde are so well preserved. And I think that's because they were scuttled, weren't they? They were sunk on purpose to block a harbor.
Yeah.
So they dig them up and go, wow, 1,000-year-old ships. Now, Camila, I'd like to ask you about side-tripping into Sweden from Copenhagen.
I was actually just going to say something about that because yeah. I have a favorite place that I would go if I had a day off in Copenhagen. It would not be crossing the bridge over to Malmö. I would go to the harbor, take a boat out to Ven.
You would?
The small island of Ven. It takes you 50 minutes and now up to an hour.
Nice.
And it's a part of Sweden, but it's just in between Denmark and Sweden.
There's an island.
There is a small island. That's actually where you have the Tycho Brahe Museum.
Okay.
And it's fantastic nature out there. You go out and
just to talk about this, the connections between
yeah.
Denmark and Sweden.
Yeah.
Malmö and Lund are two sizable cities in Sweden.
Yes.
The biggest urban area in Scandinavia now, I believe, is Copenhagen.
Yeah.
Because you've tied in Malmö and Lund in Sweden.
Yeah. Yeah, we did get the bridge.
Remarkable engineering, what Denmark
yeah.
is doing.
Yeah.
I was just in Hamburg a couple months ago, and they're building a new massive bridge where Hamburg and Copenhagen are going to be like sister cities.
They're still, I don't think they started the construction, but they're going to make a bridge between Denmark and Germany.
And believe it or not, Hamburg and Copenhagen dream of sharing the Olympics.
Oh, yeah.
Coming up in 2040 or something like that. That's what
we are ready.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. I'm talking with Anja Kuznar and Camila Kolding Jorgensen. We're talking about side tripping from Copenhagen. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. You can email us at radio@ricksteves.com. Neil's calling in from Milwaukee in Wisconsin. Hey, Neil, thanks for your call.
How are you doing?
Doing great. Have you traveled in Denmark?
I have, and I've covered quite a bit of territory outside of Copenhagen and found it fascinating and would encourage anyone to do it. One of the really easy ones to do is to hop on a train from the Copenhagen station, and in about 40 or 45 minutes, you can be in Hillerød to visit Frederiksborg Castle. It's not the same as the city of Frederiksborg, but it's Frederiksborg Castle, and just a spectacular castle on a set of three islands in a lake, and just beautiful to approach with lovely gardens, easy to get to after you arrive. you can either walk directly to the castle or take a boat across this beautiful little pond and approach that way. And I think it's often referred to as the Danish Versailles, and the advantage that it has over places like Versailles and many places in Europe right now, the crowding that has been talked about so much, this is a place that I've spent time in with almost no one in the same room. It's a spectacular chapel with no one else in there, and just a lovely, lovely spot.
And Neil, you were talking about the approach, and I was right there with you, because it just seems like a cute little toy soldier world as you walk from the train station in a lovely town through a park, and it's a pedestrian-friendly area, and you got the moat that now is a lake with swans in it, and you've got little cafes and what were the bastions. And then you come into the clip-clop cobbled courtyard, and you're just surrounded by all of this royal Danish brickwork. And then you step inside, and this Danish Versailles, it's like an interactive history book, because you're walking through there and you see all these portraits of the royal families and the great battles, and the reminder that Denmark was at one time one of Europe's military powers and a big deal. Camilla, give us a few tips on the castle there, Frederiksborg.
One of the things that I would go and visiting the castle is the church. The castle church.
Yeah.
It's very small, but it's extremely beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
So that's definitely worth a visit.
And Anya, how about you? What would you particularly enjoy about a trip? It's just like 45 minutes, Neil said, from Copenhagen. It's amazing to just pop on a train and you get there easy.
Yeah, well, this used to be a Danish king's and queen's coronation site for 200 years. And this is a place where royal weddings took place. So it is a very magical place to visit.
Hey, Neil, you mentioned you've got plenty of enjoyable memories side-tripping out of Copenhagen. What's another place that might not be on our radar that you would recommend knowing about?
Well, Aarhus, of course, which is, I think, the second biggest city. There's a spectacular modern art museum and then an open-air town museum where many buildings from elsewhere in Denmark have been located over the years, and creates a sense of older times in Denmark in a kind of interactive setting. So Aarhus is a great place to visit, but there have been so many, and some of them just towns filled with public art that, you know, they've just committed to that as a value to their citizens. So great fun from that standpoint.
So it sounds like you're a fan of recognizing that there's a lot to see in Denmark outside of Copenhagen.
And the one thing I'd say about visiting the castle in Frederiksborg is remember to look up. It is one of those places where the decorated ceilings are just awe-inspiring. There's
great.
The portraits on the wall, but then great art up above you.
Good advice. Good advice. Thanks, Neil, for your call.
Thank you.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking about side-tripping from Copenhagen in the beautiful Hooghly country of Denmark. Our guests are Anya Kuznar and Camilla Kolding Jorgensen. Hey, Camilla, I think I remember that word, Hooghly?
Hooghly, yeah.
What does that mean?
That means basically cozy.
Cozy.
But it's not just a word, it's a state of mind. It's just a way of being together or being alone. It's actually very difficult to explain because you just have to feel it.
But if you've been in the countryside in a small town, if you've been walking around on the waterfront in Aeroskoping, for example.
And that's a Hooghly
town.
Yeah.
Now, one thing that everybody who has been or still is a kid likes is
Odense, H.C. Andersen.
What's that?
Yeah, Hans Christian Andersen.
Jose, H.C., H.C. Well, yeah, if you're interested in Jose, Hans Christian Andersen, how do you best experience that?
In Odense. You go and visit his house and
it's a wonderful museum for Hans Christian Andersen. And I feel like I'm just skipping and delighting in a children's parade right now when I think about Hans Christian Andersen in Odense. But what I was going for was not Jose, H.C. Mm-hmm. I was going for Legoland.
Oh, yeah, Beyond.
And Anya, have you been to Legoland?
Oh, yes, I've been there. Even as a grown-up, you would just enjoy walking through the structures made with Legos. Yeah,
I love Legoland. And I felt so conflicted because I'm supposed to be a mature adult, and I had the opportunity to go to Legoland to work on my Denmark book. And my son is was a fanatic Lego kid, you know, and he never got to go to Legoland, but I got to go to Legoland. But Legoland has like millions and millions of little tiny Legos putting together the Acropolis, the Eiffel Tower, the Great Wall of China, you name it. You can travel around the world.
Yeah.
It must be a great experience for parents to take their kids to Legoland.
Absolutely.
It's a destination where you can sleep over, have a full board.
Yeah.
It's
accommodation.
Sort of a, you know, it's kind of like a Hoogly Disneyland.
Yep.
It is, yeah.
There's something more cute and charming about it than big, aggressive Disneyland, you know, and it's just as great for families.
Absolutely. And it's a pilgrimage site for the European families, I would say.
Oh, yeah. This is Travel with Rick Steves. I'm talking with Anja Kuznar and Camila Kolding-Jorgensen, and we're talking about side-tripping from Copenhagen to understand other dimensions of Denmark. Anja tells us how she developed her Danish language skills by teaching kindergarten and more about parental benefits in Danish society. That's in an extra to today's interview, and you can listen to that at ricksteves.com/radio. Our phone number is 877-333-7425, and Carolyn is using that phone number right now from San Diego. Hey, Carolyn.
Hello.
What's your tip for us thinking of how can we spice up our trip by going someplace maybe off the radar that's a side trip from Copenhagen?
Well, this place is very off the radar, off the beaten path, they say. It's called the Tranekker International Center for Art and Nature. I believe you actually have to drive there. It's on one of the larger islands in Denmark called Langeland, and it's a park, but it's around a castle, Tranekker Slot. The castle is not open year-round, but it is open sometimes. When we were there, we just walked around the installation of art around the lake. So there's a castle, there's a lake, then you can walk all around it, and then they have nature and art installations, and a lot of them involve old-growth trees. It's walking around a forest.
Wow.
And really beautiful. When we were there, there was no fee to enter, but I was looking it up. It looks like it only costs about 25 Danish krona, which is very inexpensive.
That'd be like $3 or $4 or something like that.
It's just beautiful and just really interesting sculpture in amongst nature.
Wow. Well, that's by the name, Center for Art and Nature. And Carolyn, I'll spell the name here, Tranekker, T-R-A-N-E-K-A-E-R, Tranekker?
Yes.
Tranekker International Center for Kunst og Natur.
And I just look for nature parks and sculpture parks around the world. And
yeah.
My best friends moved to Denmark, married a Danish scientist about 25 years ago. And so we've done many trips around Denmark. I was very lucky. And also into Sweden. There's beautiful things.
Oh, yeah.
There too,
so you can mix up nature and art. And, if I just think about it right now, I'm going to think Norway, Sweden, Denmark. I can think of many opportunities to mix nature and art. That's kind of a cool Nordic thing. Hey, Carolyn, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
So Carolyn was talking about Tranekker Center for Art and Nature, but I don't know the full name of Louisiana, but there's a museum just north of Copenhagen that mixes modern art and nature quite nicely. Camila, what am I talking about?
Yeah, you're talking about Louisiana.
Louisiana,
it's called, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a museum. You take the train from Copenhagen.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, half an hour up there. And
it's
then
like a big park?
It's both outside and inside.
Yeah.
There is the building with the exhibition,
uh-huh.
and it changes from time to time. And then there are, like, sculptures outside in the park.
I love it. That's another example of why you could not see anything in Copenhagen and do a whole trip side-tripping out. We've been kind of going around in a circle. Anja, is there another place that you'd recommend considering outside of Copenhagen we've yet to talk about?
I would take trains up north, remaining on the island of Sjælland and
uh-huh.
visiting places such as Gilleleje or Tinsvilla.
Uh-huh.
These are small harbor towns where you can buy fresh fish, sit on a bench, grab a picnic lunch. That's a very Danish thing to do.
I could imagine you could take a train for an hour north of Copenhagen and get off at any town on the water.
Exactly.
And have a wonderful experience.
Yeah.
In fact, the less you know that town, the better, because there'd be no tourists there.
And let me tell you, Rick, in Copenhagen, there are also udflugtbørnehaver. That means daycare centers where every day they would provide a day trip for the kids. So they would leave early in the morning on the bus and return very tired at the end of the day. The parents simply
Mission
love
accomplished.
It.
That's great. I bet one place they might go is Bakken.
And Bakken, oh, yeah. Yeah, the park, yeah.
Now, and I like to bring up Bakken because everybody goes to Tivoli.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Tivoli is great. It's an elegant kind of Danish Disneyland right mm-hmm. across the street from the train station in Copenhagen.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if you want a more local, laid-back, nature-infused Tivoli experience, I really like Bakken.
Yeah, I would definitely take the S train up to Klampenborg, which is the station. And then you have, it's out in the forest, yeah. and you have this Bakken. It is an amusement park. Yeah. A very old place as well, like Tivoli.
Oh, yeah. I do like that. It's sort of, it feels Victorian or 19th century, you know. Or
absolutely, yeah.
Something
yeah.
about it. It's very charming from the old days.
Yeah.
Anya, do you have any memories from Bakken?
Yeah, we would just sit on a blanket. The kids would play. We would have a sandwich. And that would be a hugelit moment for all of us.
Open face sandwich?
Yep, of course. Smørrebrød.
Smørrebrød, yeah.
That's another higgly part of Denmark. What a delight to talk to both of you. Anya Kuznar and Camilla Kolding Jørgensen. Tusen takk, can I say?
Tak skal du have.
Can I say taksamika? Mange tak.
Yeah.
Many thanks. Tak.
Thank you. Thank you.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton, Kaz Murrah-Hall, and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. You'll find more about our guests at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
The Rick Steves guidebooks, over 50 of them, are consistently the best-selling series of guides to Europe. That's because we lovingly update them in person so you can enjoy maximum travel thrills for every mile, minute, and dollar in your next trip. Find them at your favorite bookseller and at ricksteves.com.